Welcome to the She Wore Black podcast. I'm Agatha Andrews. Today, Nalini Singh joins me to talk about Archangel's Lineage, her latest book in her Guildhunter series. We discuss genre merging, the immortal appeal of angels as characters, her writing schedule, and what's next in her Psy-Changeling series. I have Archangel's Lineage in my bookshop if you want to support both the podcast as well as independent bookstores nationwide at bookshop.org/shop/sheworeblack. If you want another way to help out the show, you can follow me on Instagram, Facebook, and Threads, and leave me a review wherever you get your podcasts. You can also join my Patreon community, buy merch, or make a coffee donation through the links available on my website at sheworeblackpodcast.com. Thanks for joining me today. Now, on to the show. Well, Nalini Singh, this is such a pleasure to have you on today. My listeners have messaged me in droves, very enthused about your coming appearance. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, I have Archangel's Lineage in my hand. So many of my listeners were so excited that you were coming on, and they're very curious about this book, but also your next Psy-Changeling series, which we'll get to towards the end. But if you could let listeners know what you have going on in Archangel's Lineage.
Okay, so Archangel's Lineage has to do a lot with family, as is implied by the title, but there's also a big political thing with the archangels that goes on in this book, and I don't want to spoil that for anyone, but just know that big changes are coming, and you're about to meet someone that is most unexpected, I'll put it like that. But we also deal a lot with, for readers who are familiar with the series, we deal a lot with Elena's family history as well, which has, you know, it's haunted her all these years, and things kind of come to a head in this book, and so it's a very emotional book. You know, there were a lot of tears when I was writing it as well, but at the same time there's a lot of good emotions too, so I'll leave it at that. But I think if you've been following the books and you've been following Elena and Raphael's story, this is a very important book in their story, and it closes quite a few, you know, open loops and gives us quite a few answers.
Well, you might be wondering, like, why is this gothic and horror person inviting me on the show? But there are reasons. And namely, I've actually had quite a few paranormal romance writers on this gothic and horror podcast, because I love that space where gothic horror and romance come together. Laurel K. Hamilton's episode remains my highest rated, closely followed by Grady Hendrix. And the only reason why I say that is because I think it speaks to how fans of horror also love the kind of work that you do. And so comments on my Romanticy episode with our friend Sarah Wendell were a huge testament to you, because they talked about you a lot in those comments. They loved your work and were going on about it. So that was another thing that piqued my interest. I was like, oh, okay, my listeners really want to hear Nalini sing. This is exciting. But, you know, it speaks to their huge testament to you and how much they love your books. But for horror fans that may not be familiar, can you tell us how and why romance is a legitimate space to explore some of the same things that you find in horror?
I think, so the Guildhunter series probably came up because it's quite a good example of horror-esque stuff that happens, you know, within the confines of a romantic series. I quite often warn people who are starting my books, like, if you don't mind a bit more sort of blood and gore, the Guildhunters, you know, go for that. Otherwise, maybe stick to the Psy-Changeling series. and I think it's because both horror, gothic, romance, all of them are built on a basis of emotion. And it's just which emotion we punch up as to what genre it gets put into. So, you know, all of them have that dread you know, when you have the really dark scenes. It just so happens that in horror, you just keep punching up the dread and, you know, even more horrible things happen. Whereas in romance, we use the dread to add depth to the romance that's going on. So it's like making a recipe, but you're putting different amounts of each emotion in, you know, in each type of book. And I also think sometimes the genre boundaries are kind of, I know someone just puts a label on it and that's what we call it, but it could as easily fit in something else. Like there are some books that are tagged horror, but they could as easily be romances because they do end up together at the end. It just so happens that they've been through a very horrifying kind of experience. But they still have that romantic relationship that's a thread throughout the series. And I think Laurel K. Hamilton is actually an interesting example of that, because I feel like a lot of her work straddles those boundaries. It could be put into any genre, depending on any of those genres, you know, depending on who was doing the labeling.
Yes.
And it's also what the reader's reading for. Like some readers might be reading for the romantic relationship, so that's what they're focusing on. Whereas other readers might be reading for the horror or the gothic architecture, you know, that they find really interesting. So yeah, it's definitely a lot of crossover. A lot of crossover.
I mean, when you look at the history of Gothic romance, I mean, that's a perfect example of the merging of these things. And so, and when I started the podcast, it was because I do walk in both worlds. I write and read horror and I write and read romance. And at that time, I didn't see a lot of members of the communities talking to each other, but they wanted the same things. And I was like, guys, romance has been exploring horror for decades. I mean, you know, for ages and ages. And so I just really wanted to have a space where we had those conversations. And, you know, I've had like Jane Ann Krantz. And I'm like, if you go back and look at some of her Amanda Quick, like some of those stories will have like murderous scenes that read very much like the kind of scenes you see in slashers, not just because there's murder or because there's blood, but literally like the way she writes the scene is identical. And so I'm like, this has really been happening for a very long time. And I found it interesting, you know, kind of going through your work and going through a lot of other work, going like, there's so much. If people in the horror community only knew how much was going on in romance that covered a lot of the same territory, you know, it's just real interesting. I think Isabel Gagnes is trying to do a lot of this merging as well. And you were talking about how like it depends on where it started or who's doing the marketing or whatever. So she's marketed in horror, but she definitely does both too. Just like you
she do. She does. The Hacienda was quite terrifying. It's excellent, but beautiful writing. But I can see why she was put in horror as opposed to romance, because again, not to spoil it for anyone who hasn't read it, but the resolution of the romance would have not been satisfying for, you know, romance readers. And quite often, it's that central element, I think, of a genre defines it. So as to what you call a book and where it gets placed, because readers who like this stuff hopefully will find it anyway. You know, it doesn't. Hopefully it doesn't matter what it's tagged as, but I think it's also important to genre labels play a part in making sure we're not promising readers what it doesn't deliver.
Right.
Because then you get people who might have otherwise enjoyed it if they'd known going into it that it was a horror as opposed to a romance, or vice versa, but they don't enjoy it because their mindset going into it as I want to read this particular kind of book and I'm getting something else altogether. It's really interesting. And I think particularly if you work in the genre space, as we both do, you can see there's a lot of gray lines.
Yes.
But there are some solid sort of don't break this genre line. Otherwise everyone's going to be really mad.
Absolutely. And we've talked about that too. And when I had her on, we talked about that, because with Vampires of El Norte, her follow-up, there is an HEA and it's intentional, because she does love romance. And she's like, I want one with an HEA. And so that, you know, that was really important to her on the follow-up.
Yeah.
And I have been able to watch, you know, romance fans like being willing to explore a space they hadn't been willing to explore before. And it's really fun. And I'm like, there's so much of it out there. And that's one of the reasons why I was like, you have some of the same themes too. And I was like, oh my gosh, there's so much to explore and talk about with that. So, and again, with Gothic romance, it's like, hello, that's been going on forever. But one of the things I also found interesting with your series, and as a librarian that, I mean, I was a librarian all the way back to the very, very like early 2000s. So I was around when, when the Guild Hunter series kicked off with Angel's Blood in 2009, and it was a huge year for Angels, which I thought was really interesting when I went back and looked at this timeline, because fallen angels and archangels that you find in your book are regular angels, and you've got angels, right? But it was also big in YA, and there were several series that launched in 2009, including Becca Fitzpatrick's Hush Hush series, Lauren Kate's Fallen series, and I do remember like having to have multiple copies of all of these things because they would just clamor for these books, right? And I'm always happy to get kids so excited that there's clamoring and wait lists and and pressure to hurry up and finish so I can read it. Lots of that was going on, which was really exciting to me as a librarian. But I do remember like being surprised by it because until that point, Neil Gaiman was really the only person I knew who had been writing Angels, like it as part, as a major part of a series or a storyline. But I feel like it also kind of all happened at once. Can you tell us how A, you chose to come to write Angels and what it was like to launch a series the same year as other people? You know, you guys work on these things for years before they're published, you know? And it just sort of happened all at one time, but it's such an unusual character type too. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so it's funny because I'm a little bit frustrating to interview in this regard because I don't consciously think about things when I'm writing. I'm very sort of compulsive when I write, and I actually wanted to write Immortals. I wanted to write Immortals as I felt like they would be, like if you had lived 1,000 years, I didn't think you would be the same as a human in any sense in your thinking and how much you valued a mortal life. And it came out of a sense of frustration because I had read quite a few sort of immortal books, different kinds of characters, but I felt like they acted too human. And I wanted to write really inhuman characters. And as for how I ended up with Angels, I can't tell you. I just wrote and it came out. But I remember one series that I did read. It's an older series. It's Sharon Shin. She wrote, what was the series called? I can't, but she wrote Angels. Like, she kind of straddled this fantasy romance sphere, and I think she was the first one sort of read that was doing that, but it was not a big, like as you said, it wasn't like a big thing, and I don't know why it all happened at the same time. You know, it seems to be this thing in like any kind of media, sometimes everybody's working, what's that word, there's a word, synchronicity, right? Yeah. Like there's this weird synchronicity, and suddenly 7 books come out and they're all about dragons, for example, because dragons are big right now. And I happen to know someone who wrote a dragon book before Fourth Wing became so huge, and it just happened their book came out after Fourth Wing, but they were writing at the same time, probably, you know. And that thing is really difficult to explain. Is it that we're all getting the same, like we're all consuming the same thing somehow, subtly, unconsciously, and it just happens to come out that way. I do know that in YA, it was huge. It was really, really huge. I know in adult romance, Angels didn't really take off for a long time. Like I was one of the few that was doing Angels in adult, and I don't know why the difference in the two sort of, you know, YA and adult. I couldn't tell you, but I mean, they're fascinating to write because you can do so much with it, and Immortals, I mean, why not with wings?
Sarah and I have talked about this before too, and actually she's talked about it on her show, kind of independent of that, but just how sometimes she's noticed, and this isn't speaking to angels specifically, but how like something that happens in the world or in, you know, whatever country that the person's writing from is in, you know, sometimes it's just kind of this thing that puts us in a place where we're wanting something. You know, I was just kind of curious. I'm like, what was going on in the early aughts?
I have no idea.
But I really enjoyed it. And I really enjoyed the enthusiasm that readers had regarding, you know, because I was like, it's such a fresh thing to think about and write about. And I love how it's still going. It's
still going.
Yes. Well, something else that I thought was interesting is that I know that like an ongoing series in romance will often take one of two routes, which is to explore each story through the lens of the same couple, or they'll explore, like each book will have a new couple that was like they were secondary characters in the previous books. And you actually do both within a series. Can you tell us about weaving this couple through a series while occasionally exploring other couples?
Yes. Yeah, so it is a very organic series. When I started, I was writing the Sideshow series, and at the time I was writing two Sideshow books a year, and I really needed to do something in between to sort of give my brain a break. And, you know, I really like to go fresh to something instead of doing it back to back. So I thought I'd do standalones in between. So Angel's Blood started out as a standalone, but I, as all my readers know, I'm terrible at standalones. And so I ended up with the series. And at first I thought, you know, I'll explore Elena and Raphael and then we'll do spin-off books, because by then, you know, I was totally invested in all these people. But I realized that, so what I want to explore in this series is not just the falling in love part of falling in love with an immortal. It's the making the love last and the solidifying of that bond. Like, yes, it's fine, you fell in love with immortal, but now what? And I find that a fascinating question. There is so much to dig into there. And you see a lot of that in some very hard questions in the Archangel's lineage. And so it just naturally felt right to follow them, not only for a year or 2 years, but decades, and, you know, even longer, possibly. And because their relationship is growing at a different pace than a mortal relationship would grow, just because of the different pressures. And immortality changes everything. You know, there's this, and she's adapting to this whole new world that she's been plucked from, the life she knew, into this whole different world. So basically the series kind of begins where other series end, with the happier ever after. So their happier ever after, you know, is a long-term one, because I didn't want to do the, you know, break them up, put them back together. That I wasn't interested in that. What I wanted to do was what happens when two very stubborn, very strong-willed people fall madly in love, and then also on top of that, they have to deal with the fact he's an archangel. And, you know, she begins as a mortal. There's a huge power differential. And how do you handle that? How do you deal with that? And so following them long term was just came naturally. But what I realized as I was going through the books was that I was really interested in the other secondary characters. And they're quite important part of Elena and Raphael's lives as well. So, and I liked having a break between the Elena and Raphael books. So I didn't want to be continuously following them, because I thought, you know, they need to have their space to grow as well. So then by the time we circle back to them, there's changes and there's new things. And so with each book, we explore something different, the next level of the relationship. And I really enjoyed playing around with the series that way. And I'm very lucky my editor, Cindy, is like, okay, that's not what romance authors do, but go for it. So yeah. she's been really flexible to how I've structured the series.
I love that you said all of that, because I do hear writers, particularly screenwriters, I think more than regular book writers. And maybe that's because there's a little bit more flexibility with books. I don't know if that's true or not. I'm making that up right now. but I've heard that they feel like moonlighting kind of set this precedent where, like, once they get together, it's like not interesting anymore. And I don't think it has to be that way.
No,
I think there's, as you said, I there's so much to explore. And this has come up with regard to Miss Scarlet and the Duke, which is that BBC show. I mean, people were like, we want them together. And I know that that's one of the writers who was like, but moonlighting. And it's like, it doesn't have to be that way.
You know? It's actually one of the challenges of writing the series for me. Is always keeping it relevant and always wanting readers to feel like they want to follow them, even though they are together. And they have very, you know, consciously said that we're together. We're in this for the long haul. You know, if you fall, I fall too. It's like a sort of epic love story that's, you know, through time. And when I started thinking, how am I going to carry this through? This is one of the things I thought about. I thought, is how do you do it? How do you keep it interesting? And so that was also a driver for me as a writer to keep it interesting. And I think it's the constant growth that keeps it interesting. Where something like that flatlines is where they're just happy. I mean, that's very nice to read in an epilogue. And nothing happens, like it's just a constant sort of happiness and there's no development, emotional development, no more. And I think for a series where you follow the same characters over a long period, especially if they're together, there has to be a lot of growth. There's and a lot of change, and change is not necessarily bad. It's just change, you know. For example, I'll just spoil the first book a bit. Like Elena goes from mortal to immortal and she ends up with wings. And so the second book, she actually has to learn how to use those wings, because you can't just wake up with wings and suddenly you can fly around. You haven't got the muscle structure to make them work. And you know, one of my favorite scenes is he literally just pushes her off like you would a baby bird, so that she's like, you have to push me, I can't do it, you know. And but it's that's a physical thing. You know, like that's a physical growth that you can weave into a story. But the emotional growth is just as important, even more so, because that's what drives it forward. Yeah.
This may sound silly, but as a woman who's 50 years old, I really appreciate this, because, and I think I've seen this trend or this interest more and more, to the point where there's a hashtag, and I'll be doing an episode with Sarah, called like crone lit, not that your characters are crone, but just this idea of, we don't stop being interesting as people once we hit 30, you know, like growing as a couple isn't actually an interesting idea. You know, it's an interesting, you want to keep rooting for someone even after the first story. And so I think maybe reading that at 25 might've been different, but as a 50-year-old woman, I find that really interesting. And I see a different appeal to following a couple like that.
And I think, you know, it helps with, so I'm not writing contemporary, right? Like I'm not writing just contemporary romance. The books are contemporary, but they're urban fantasy. So you've got angels and vampires, and you've got a lot of political stuff happening and upheaval in the world. So I think it would be harder to do it in a contemporary where it was just, the focus is just on the couple, because you have to really dig deep without breaking them up. And it can be done, but I don't know if you could do it for as long. With my series, there's so much happening that some of the books are very much focused externally on what's happening. So they're fighting a battle. There's a war happening. And so it's not so much about them as it is about this massive cataclysm that's happening to the world, and they have to work together, while other books are more focused on them. And I think that ability to zoom in and out of their relationship. So sometimes we focus on the bigger world picture of what's going on. So there's quite a strong external plot line as well as the internal emotional plot line. I think that's why the series works, because you can balance it off.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I have a writer question for you because I have writers that listen to the show. You are rather prolific, to say the least. And can you walk us through your writing schedule and speak to the discipline of your work ethic, especially when you, and this is what fascinates me especially, because you're writing more than one epic series.
Yeah, so I tell you how to get very disciplined at writing is to be going to law school and trying to write books at the same time. And then I actually worked in a law firm, like a commercial law firm, and basically had no life and wrote in like tiny, tiny blocks. And so it's actually, I think, one way to, if you do have readers who are trying to write more, is to teach yourself to write in short bursts, because I think quite often we have this thing in our mind that we have to set everything up, we have to have our candle, we have to, have the music going, and it's, I mean, that's great,
The
that's great,
candle.
that's the perfect, when you have that, or your aromatherapy or whatever, if that's your perfect writing day, that's wonderful. Everyone has their perfect writing day, but the rest of the time you have to use the time you have, and it's really, really good for your long term, I think, writing career if you can learn to use those bursts. Like, I literally wrote on the bus. I wrote on the bus in a notebook, and then I just transcribed it at home because I was brain dead by the time I came home. So, like, I was so tired, and I would just type it in. So that's one thing. So I learned very early to utilize that time, and I still do it. Like, before this podcast, I set everything up, and then I was writing. Even though, because I was doing something else before then, the time in between is only about 30 minutes that I could do, but I did, and I got really into it. And then I was like, oh, I have to pull out and stop. Obviously, that's not my perfect writing time. That's not me getting like, focused time of 45 minutes to an hour each time kind of thing. But it was still fantastic, and I got multiple pages edited during that time. So that's one thing. The other thing is I don't like deadlines. Like, in the sense, I like deadlines in that they give me a point that I know the book has to be in by. I don't like writing to deadline, as in at the last minute rushing to finish something. And I was the same as a kid, doing exams. I don't like cramming at the last minute. I'm just not built for that. And I think you have to figure out what kind of writer you are, what you're naturally built to, and then build your writing around that. So mine is built around steady work, steady pace, so that by the time I get to the deadline, the book's done and I can hand it in happy that I've been able to spend the time I wanted on it, as opposed to rushing. I do know some friends who are just, they're maniacs. They like to write in that intense, that final, oh my God, I have to write 50,000 words in 5 days, and I'm like, are you insane?
Oh my God.
But everyone has their thing, right? So you need to know what yours is, and I would suggest for the long term you try for steady, because constantly doing that sort of racing to the deadline burnout thing is just not, I don't think it's you can keep that up. You can do that for one book or two, but you can't maintain it over a long period. So and be really honest about the writing time you have. So I'm a full-time writer, but when I was working and writing, I had to learn to be really honest and not set myself goals that I was going to inevitably fail, because I just was not being honest. Like, if you have kids, you're going to have, what are you doing for your kids that's taking up your time? What else are you doing? And then you figure out what your writing time is. And then once you figure that out, that time should be sacrosanct. Like, if for some people it's 5:30 in the morning till 6:30, that's their writing time. They get up, they just, for that hour they write, and I think it's really important to protect that time, particularly in the current world where our phones have become like this massive time suck. And it even happened to me, even though I'm quite aware of protecting my writing time, I just found it was being frittered away. And so what I tell people now is you have to really turn off the Wi-Fi. You don't need the interruptions of your email pinging, because each time it pings, it's your brain has to reset to get back into the story. So yeah, just write in a bubble if you can. Even if you are on the bus, write in a mental bubble. tune, you know, put on your headphones. I use rain sounds as my white noise and just go.
I think you're right that we do need to protect our bubble, certainly, because I do get pulled out and completely have to shift gears. And then I get distracted too. Like, wait, do I have to do the dishes now? Wait, I can do the, you know, and it's just nonsense. So,
yeah, because if you learn to do that bubbling, you can actually write like 500 words. You can write in 10 minutes. If you know how to get into your zone very quickly. And I mean, if we want to talk writing, we can get into if you're a planner or if you just write, but at the base of it is having the time to write and protecting that time. I think you start there. That has to be the most important thing. Yeah.
Are you a plotter or a pantser?
I kind of fall in between. Yeah. I, as long as I know the overarching plot line of the series, I can just go into a book with, I don't know, I just write it. Like, I write very fast first drafts because no one's ever going to see my first drafts. They're chaos on the page. But yeah, as long as I know where I'm taking the reader long term, I pull myself back from going off on tangents. So that works for me. So I guess I plot the overall plot line. And then for each book, I kind of roughly have an idea and then I just figure it out.
That's so impressive because you have such two huge series. So that's so impressive. I do have a question from my Patreon from a longtime fan of yours. Librarian and listener Jocelyn Codner is a huge fan of your Psychangeling series, but also loves There Should Have Been Eight, which I didn't know about. So I'm very happy that she shared this with me because then I saw what it was about and I was like, oh, how do I not know about this? This is amazing. it's your mystery thriller that takes place in a Gothic mansion. She asks, does she have plans to write more contemporary thrillers?
Yes. I actually have. So later in the year, I'm going to be writing my fourth one. And yeah, I'm intending to continue writing them because I really do enjoy just something that different and it's fun playing with the thriller elements, which is very different from romance beats. And yeah. And writing There Should Have Been Eight, you know, having all those gothic-y kind of creepy vibes in there was really fun as well.
I have no idea why I didn't know about this, but I'm so glad that Jocelyn asked this question because now I'm going to hunt it down. So that only came out last year though, right? That one?
There Should Have Been Eight, was it? Yeah, last year it came out. Yeah, so I've only done three, so I'm not super well known in like the thriller space. All of the books are set in New Zealand because I was like, why not? We have all the same prerequisites as like Nordic noir, you know, with the really empty landscapes, very small population, lots of places where creepy things can happen, and the landscape does play a big part in the books because it is again that feeling of this beautiful, breathtaking landscape that can also kill you. So it's really fun, and it means I can do lots of trips around New Zealand for lots of, you know, research beautiful places that I can then turn deadly. So it's good fun. I really enjoy it.
Checks all my boxes. Well, and it's interesting because a number of romance writers also do the same, where they'll cross that bridge into mystery. I've had Sherry Thomas on the show a few times. And, you know, let's see, I have Alyssa Cole right here. I'm examining that one for, you know, and she's done a few already as well. And there's a whole list. There's a bunch of them who write romance and are known for romance, but then cross over into mystery. What is the draw? And is that writing experience natural to you, or were there unique challenges since you are, you know, you do get comfortable in a genre and know those beats really well? Like, how was that process for you?
I don't know how it is for everyone else, but I know for me, so I also want to say Alyssa's latest book, One of Us Knows. Yeah, it's brilliant. You guys have to read it. It's so good. I'm just so excited for people to read this book. But anyway, so for me,
I'm excited too, actually.
It's so good. For your readers who don't know, it's the protagonist has dissociative identity disorder. So when they say one of us knows, it's one of herself. You know, it's so good. She's done such a good job of it. But I know for me, I've always read very widely, and alongside romance, mysteries have always been a love that I've always loved to read. So I was very familiar with the beats of mystery, or thrillers, you know, that suspense space. And if you actually look at the Guild Hunter series, they all have mysteries in them. It just so happens that the mysteries are, you know, urban fantasy, paranormal type mysteries involving vampires or archangels or, you know, all that kind of stuff. So it wasn't as much a transition as it might seem from the outside. I knew how to structure that kind of a book. But at the same time, I was always used to having a very strong romance thread that tied everything together, right? So with a thriller, my very first thriller, Madness of Sunshine, you can see that I still have a slight romance thread, because that came naturally to me to have that thread in there. I wouldn't call it romantic suspense, because it's not enough romance in there for that, but it did still have that thread of romance. And then with my next thriller, Quiet in Her Bones, I sort of felt like I hit my groove, and that one has no romance. You know, it is a straight thriller. And then again, There Should Have Been Eight is the same. It's a straight thriller. And so I did have to learn, like, what, like, you know how we're talking about zooming in and out of certain things? Like, I had to learn consciously how to zoom into the thriller elements and not so much the, like, the sort of relationship elements, because I didn't want to be writing romantic suspense. I wanted to be writing something completely different. I wanted to explore the thriller space. So yeah, it was a learning curve, but I think that's good. You know, that's part of why I do it, because so last year was my 20th anniversary, you know, as a published author, and I want to keep pushing myself, you know, in the next 20 years, what am I going to do? And I want to keep learning new things and trying new things, and maybe I'll fall flat on my face for some of them, but that's okay. Nobody has to know. I can just do it, because I wrote my first thriller. I didn't tell anybody I was writing it. I just wrote it to see if I could write it. And I do that quite often. I like to play with ideas and concepts. And so I think if you're an experienced writer, it is, you can, you know, swap genres, or like swap around and do multiple genres, because you have a more conscious understanding of how books are structured. And so I'm not like I'm not a plotter. I don't consciously think about things when I'm writing, but when I get to editing my own work, I am more conscious. Like, I know that a story needs to have certain elements to fulfill that genre's what readers expect from it, and what I would expect from it as a reader if I was picking up a book. So I do think it does make it easier to genre swap if you have, you know, a bit of a track record, and you need to read.
Yeah.
I still read so much, and I think the worst thing you can do once you start writing is to stop reading. It's, you need to make time for your reading, because you learn so much just by reading other stories, and that place in your brain is fed, you know, that creative space. Your style might be completely different to your favorite authors, and it should be, you know, because you're you. But I don't know, just feeding the creative soul is important. Yeah.
You said something in there that I thought was really interesting and important, I think, for, because, you know, I do try to talk about how there's so much in common between these worlds or places to explore. And you talked about romantic suspense. And for anybody who hasn't yet listened to my Jane Anne Krantz episode, where we kind of break it down what romantic suspense is, you know, romantic suspense has equal time for the mystery as well as the romance. And, you know, a lot of times what happens with Gothic if there's a romance and it's not a gothic romance per se, because gothic romance works like romantic suspense in that they have equal, you have to have the HEA and you have to have like the gothic story and they share space. But if it's a gothic that like the Hacienda that happens to have a romantic element, that is different. It's something simmering beneath the surface of another thing. Yes. And I like that you just talked about that with exploring thriller and stuff for yourself, because it is a different objective.
It is, yeah. And I think this is not so much when you're first starting out. So when you're first starting out as a writer, it's quite natural to explore and kind of figure out who you are. You don't have to label anything. Like, you don't have to put chains on yourself in any way, you know, just go free. But if you are someone who is writing a particular kind of thing, like you're aiming for a particular kind of genre, and you're at the space where you know that's where you want to be, then you have to understand what is it that this genre needs to be the genre. Otherwise, again, we go back to what we talked about earlier, which is mislabeling, which can be terrible. It could be a great book, but if it's mislabeled, it's finding the wrong audience. And I think that's important for writers to be aware of. I think sometimes people think, oh, if I put this label on it, more people will read it. But what will happen is you'll just end up with more one-star reviews because that's not your audience. You know, you have to find your audience. And so you have to be, that's when you have to consider, you know, you have to know the genre inside out that you want to be writing. And yeah, you have to consider, who is this book for? First of all, it should be for you. Like, I always write the books for myself first because I have to love it before I, you know, hand it in. But other than that, who is your ideal reader? You know, who is the person you want to pick up the book? And then you have to know, like, what, like you said, what is at the top and what is simmering underneath? Because there's so many blendings, you know, in fiction, there's so many different blendings, and there's space for everyone.
It's funny that you say that too, because like very early on, like a couple of years ago when I started, I had some authors on that wrote erotic horror, and kind of going back to this idea of you saying, you know, there are people, and we see it all the time on socials, where they try to say, well, this is still a romance, even if it doesn't check these romance boxes. And as you said, that all that does is disrupt, you know, prospective readers who will have an expectation, a romance expectation. And these erotic horror authors were like, but that's not our objective. And it's a shame whenever people don't understand when someone's not trying to play in a sandbox, but they keep getting put in a sandbox.
Yeah.
They're like, no, we're using the horror to explore, or the erotic to explore fear. We're not using it to explore romance. You know, it's a different objective. And so it doesn't seem like people try to break down these genre expectations, but in the end, the readers are going to respond to what they want, you know? And if it doesn't work out for you because you put the wrong thing on there, then...
I think it's a better space for readers now, which is there's so much information that's available. So, you know, so many reviews and things like that. So hopefully your erotic horror writers, you know, hopefully they've got enough reviews and things out there that people know going in what it is. I mean, you can't control it. As you said, you can't control it. Once a book is out there, like, don't read reviews, people. Don't read. If you're a writer, don't read your reviews. It'll just, you'll need therapy. You know, just write your book. The book's already written. You can't do anything about it. It is what it is. And I'm of the view, you know, I wrote the book I wanted to write and I did the best I could. And now it's there for the readers and the reviews are for the readers. And I need to just step back and write my next book, because I think, particularly, you know, when I was young, I was very new at writing and publishing. I would read the reviews, and then it didn't matter if there were 10 really nice reviews. If there was one really horrible one, that's the one that I would focus on. And then it affected my writing because I was like, but this person just hated what I wrote. And then I sort of had a moment of revelation. So I got two emails, one after the other, literally in my inbox. They're just sitting one on top of the other. One was like, I love this thing in your book, it's so fantastic. Next one was like the absolute opposite. I hate the same thing in your book, I absolutely hate it. And I thought, you know what? It's I can never please everybody, so I have to just let that go and, you know, trust my voice and trust my story choices, and then set it free and stop reading reviews.
Good advice. Good advice. Well, speaking of your next book, because you were saying you just have to move on to your next book. You have another one coming out this summer. It's a Psy Changeling book called Primal Mirror. Can you let them know what it's all about?
Yeah, so Primal Mirror is, how shall I put it? So in the Psy Changeling world, you know, you have the Psy who have huge psychic abilities like telepathy, telekinesis, and they're all connected to the Psynet, which gives them biofeedback their brains need for survival, right? But that Psynet is breaking down at a catastrophic rate, and if they're not connected to the Psynet, they die. And so basically the survival of this entire race of people is at stake, you know. So that's the big sort of big overarching plot line happening. And in this book, things come to a real head in that, in terms of what's happening. But in terms of the characters, we're with the child of someone very evil and very powerful, and we don't know going in who she is. Like, is she good? Is she evil? What role did she play in what her parent did? And she ends up in the territory of this very small pack of changelings who are shapeshifters, and it's kind of, you know, fire and ice, and it's they both have, like, do we trust the other one? Like, it's the same question for both of them, is the trust question. But with the Side Changing series, it's always had a very warm heart. So family is a big part of it. You know, the packs are a big part of it. Found family. And you have all those elements in this book. But something new is that we see the start of a pack. Like, this pack is very new. All the previous packs we've focused on have been quite established long term. And this is a young alpha, you know, young pack. They're not that powerful. And they're coming up against a family that is hugely powerful, a Psy family that's hugely powerful. So it's just got a different, I feel like it's got a different vibe to it because of the freshness of the pack. And both characters are, you know, they're a little bit younger, because I don't want to spoiler it, because it's, you know, it's not out till summer, but something is done to the heroine that makes her have to grow up faster. So she's usually, I write slightly sort of more mid-20s or up heroines in this world, because people live longer as well. So the series is set in like 2080, 2079 starts. So I figured, you know, people would live till 120 or 130 by that point, hopefully. So you know, I age people up for relationships and things like that. It makes sense to me. But this one is younger, because of the evil one. That's all I'll say.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Well, that's just made so many people happy to hear about that. So I want to thank you so much for joining me today. You are just such an interesting, you know, person, and your books are so creative and so fun. And I absolutely understand why people clamor for them every single time they come out. And I remember, like I said, going all the way back to the early aughts, like how excited people were to read these kinds of stories. So that always made me happy as a librarian. So it's very much my honor to have you on today. Thank you so much for joining me.
It was a really fun conversation. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining me today on She Wore Black. If you like what you heard and want to support my work on the show, you can visit my website at sheworeblackpodcast.com for links to my Patreon, my coffee donation site, as well as my merch and my online bookshop. You can also help out the show by rating me on Apple and following me on Instagram, Facebook, and Threads, and letting your friends know about the show. Thanks for joining me today, and happy reading.